Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. Thanks for listening to Here and Now. There are thousands of podcasts out there. You chose this one. It's your thing. Listening choices are a part of who you are. The choice to support your favorite NPR programs is yours, too. Visit donate.npr.org/now to donate to your station, then share why that's the kind of person you are. Tweet or create a public Facebook post with the hashtag WhyPublicRadio. From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So the Democrat, Doug Jones, is heading to Washington after winning the special Senate election in Alabama. Last night, he celebrated his victory over the Republican Roy Moore.
We have shown not just around the state of Alabama, but we have shown the country the way that we can be unified.
That's another big defeat for President Trump, who heartily endorsed Moore, despite allegations of sexual misconduct against him. But today tried to distance himself from Moore, tweeting, "The reason I originally endorsed Luther Strange, who was Moore's Republican primary opponent," and Trump continues, "Strange's numbers went up mightily, is that Roy Moore can't win. I was right." NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Domenico, what kind of infighting in the Republican Party in the White House does that reveal?
Well, I think at this point, you know, you had Steve Bannon, who is President Trump's chief strategist formerly, who had campaigned pretty hard for Roy Moore, had convinced the president that Roy Moore would win, and he didn't. So this is probably going to make President Trump rethink who he talks to, who he listens to, and probably makes him even more of a wild card than he already is.
Well, but shouldn't it also reveal, you know, if you really believe something, stick with it? And on the other hand, some might ask, was the president's endorsement part of why Moore didn't win? But exit polls showed a lot of Republicans who voted for Moore did so because they wanted to support Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think it's probably the opposite. I mean, I think that President Trump probably helped more than he hurt him, for sure. I mean, I think that President Trump is somebody with a generally pretty high standing in Alabama, although the exit polls showed a split in Alabama on how they view President Trump. But he's somebody who won 60% of the vote plus in the state and would probably do so again if he ran. Mm-hmm. Roy Moore has been a historically bad candidate in the state. He only won his chief justice race in 2012 by 4 percentage points when Mitt Romney won by a whole lot more. There were 200,000 Republicans who didn't vote for Roy Moore who did vote for Mitt Romney. And Romney had actually gotten fewer votes than John McCain in 2008. So Moore, not a great candidate. Trump probably helped him. But at the same time, the parallels between Trump and Moore are absolutely undeniable and certainly fired up a lot of Democrats in the state who might not have been fired up in the 2016 election in the same way. You had a lot of black Democrats in particular who felt like they had an obligation to go out and vote, and they did so.
Historical African-American turnout. They called it the woke vote. Activists did, got out and did that. What else? Just before we leave from that, what else do you think made the difference?
Well, one thing that I wanted to pay attention to pretty closely was whether or not Doug Jones got any Republican crossover, because 30% of the electorate last night was African-American, which is roughly similar to what President Obama got, although more than what President Obama got in 2008 when Obama got the most votes of any Democrat in state history. But still, Obama lost by 21 points. Mm-hmm. So there had to be some crossover Republicans. Well, Jones didn't get crossovers that much of them anyway. He got 8%, which was somewhat significant. But what was really the big number, we've seen nationally a lot of independents have now started to identify – well, a lot of people who are formerly Republican are identifying as independents. And that may have been the case in Alabama because Jones won independents last night by 8 points. Mm-hmm. But in 2012, the last time we had exit polling from the state, Mitt Romney won them by 52 points.
Yeah.
So that's a 60-point shift over the last several years.
OK. Part of President Trump's plea for people to vote for Moore was that the Republicans needed this guy, as he said, to make the Make America Great Again agenda work. And he was referring specifically to the new tax plan. Today we're hearing that House and Senate Republican leaders have reconciled in principle their two tax plans. The Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer, is asking that they wait on a vote until Doug Jones is seated. Is that likely to happen?
I'd say fat chance of it happening. And the reason I say that, even though we could talk about all the ironies here, the fact is, you know, when you look back at when Scott Brown won, Scott Brown, Harry Reid came out, the majority leader, and said at that time that we're going to wait until the new senator arrives before we do anything more on health care. So Democrats delayed doing anything more on health care. I don't think that's what's going to happen with Mitch McConnell, because the window is so narrow for them to pass this tax bill that if they were to wait any further, they probably wouldn't get it through with one less vote.
Just weigh in on the spat between Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and Donald Trump. She called on him to resign after, again, the allegations of sexual misconduct from different women. He tweeted that Gillibrand was a total flunky for Chuck Schumer, someone who would come to my office begging for campaign contributions not so long ago and would do anything for them, wink, wink. I mean, many saw that as a winking sexual reference today on the Today Show. She said it was a sexist smear intended to silence me. It won't. Who has this elevated?
Right. And the White House says that wasn't what his intention was, that he said similar things about—
That your mind had to be in the gutter if you thought—
Right,
yeah.
That your mind had to be in the gutter. But he has said other suggestive things even about men, Mitt Romney for one, and you could go Google that if you want. But, you know, the fact is here, this has probably catapulted Kirsten Gillibrand into the national spotlight in a way that she wasn't previously and is right to the front of the pack for 2020 if she wants it.
Domenico Montanaro, NPR's lead politics editor. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, now to some interesting politics happening in Germany. Leaders of Germany's major political parties met today for the first time since the September 24th election. Chancellor Angela Merkel, whose Christian Democrats took a pounding at the polls in that election, is still trying to put together a coalition government and avoid a new election. Joining us now is the BBC's Jenny Hill. She's in Berlin. Jenny, tell us more about who the players are in this meeting today.
Well, the two main players are undoubtedly Angela Merkel and the leader of the Social Democrats, her former allies in government, Martin Schulz. This is going to be a really interesting meeting, not least because Mr. Schulz, of course, took a very vociferous position after the election that he would never work with Mrs. Merkel again, that he was going to take his Social Democrats into opposition. He's rather backtracked, if not U-turned completely, and that's why we've now got the two leaders sat in the same room, ostensibly beginning the process of trying to work out whether a coalition government between them can work again. It's really controversial amongst the Social Democrats themselves, and it's by no means guaranteed it's going to work out.
And why did Schulz say after the election that he would never work with Merkel again? What's his problem with Merkel?
It's not just his problem, actually. His party did very badly in the election, as, of course, did Mrs. Merkel's Conservatives. But the thinking amongst party members and Mr. Schulz is that their time in coalition with Mrs. Merkel really damaged them, partially because it was very difficult, actually, for the electorate to work out what their party stood for. They were somewhat overshadowed by Mrs. Merkel's Conservatives. It was very difficult to work out whose policy was whose, which party was really carving out which position. So, in effect, the two coalition partners became a little bit interchangeable. And Mr. Schulz and many of his party felt that that was a real problem for the SPD. That's why he wanted to take them into opposition. They could recover their electoral base there, was his thinking, and really regain their strength. Obviously, his position has changed, partially because the president of Germany has been so concerned about Mrs. Merkel's inability to form a stable government that he's gradually pulled in party leader after party leader to the presidential palace, given them a good talking to, banged some heads together. We don't know quite what he said to Mr. Schulz, but whatever it was seems to have impressed him. And that was the beginning of this U-turn about the Social Democrats working with Mrs. Merkel again.
So what are the chances that there will be a new election if they can't put together a coalition government?
Well, there are three options on the table. Either get this coalition government going, go into minority government. So Mrs. Merkel would run a minority government, but the Social Democrats would, for example, pledge to support her on particular policy issues. That's still an option. And if both of those options fail, then it's fresh elections. It's something which the public here, if the polls are to be believed, is very keen to avoid. And of course, it's something which the two mainstream parties are pretty keen to avoid too, because there's no suggestion that they would fare any better than they did in September. And in effect, you'd be looking back perhaps at a rerun of what's already happened, so back to square one, which is why I think certainly Mrs. Merkel, and I suspect to a degree Mr. Schulz, are now so keen to actually see if, and it is still a big if they can get this coalition government working.
Merkel is a leader of Germany, obviously, but she's also one of the main leaders of Europe. What has all of this done to her power across the continent?
Well, this is really interesting. I think certainly domestically, Angela Merkel is weakened. And whilst I think it's pretty, it's too soon to say, you know, she's going to resign in the next few weeks. You know, her demise certainly isn't here just yet. But certainly I see this as the beginning of the end for Mrs. Merkel. I'm sceptical that she'll serve out a full term of 4 years if, of course, she gets a government going. And that is the general view here in Germany, that she is edging towards the end of the Merkel era is coming to an end. But, you know, on a European and a world stage, I think she still has clout, but certainly at the moment she's much quieter than usual. She's so focused on domestic affairs that she's not necessarily going to all of the events that she ordinarily would. So, for example, she didn't go to Paris along with other world leaders to discuss climate change. She has cancelled a couple of meetings here in Berlin with foreign leaders. So, you know, there is a sense that Mrs. Merkel is much quieter at the moment, that she is muted, and that she is really taking her eye, to a degree, off of the foreign policy ball while she deals with forming a stable government at home.
That's the BBC's Jenny Hill joining us from Berlin. Jenny, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
The Yayoi Kusama Infinity Mirrors exhibition at the Broad Museum in Los Angeles is entering its final weeks, and advance tickets are sold out. It's been incredibly popular. When the show was at the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington, D.C. earlier this year, it broke attendance records, doubling the museum's average attendance. One of the reasons for its popularity is that it's a huge hit on Instagram. People love posting selfies in Kusama's installations. Joining us now is Ariel Pardes, a senior associate editor at Wired, whose article, Selfie Factories, The Rise of the Made-for-Instagram Museum, is at Wired.com. Ariel, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And what makes some exhibitions like this Yayoi Kusama Infinity Mirrors so popular on Instagram?
I think part of it has to do with the fact that these exhibits are very, very immersive. So you can go to it, and rather than just sort of staring at a piece of art on the wall, you actually become a part of the art. With Infinity Mirrors, for example, you're seeing yourself reflected back to you millions and millions of times. And I think that's very appealing for people to feel sort of like they have a stake in the art and not just that they're observers.
Although at the Broad, there's also a 30-second selfie rule, so people can only stay in the Infinity Rooms for 30 seconds before they move on. There are big lines. How does this impact the experience of visitors to the museum?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I think something we've seen with these types of exhibits is that people are willing to wait in line for hours and hours just to be able to get in and snap that selfie. And I think these sort of rules on how long you can spend in there trying to document the experience are sort of a way to get more people in the space, but also to sort of minimize how much of that time is spent selfieing or Snapchatting or Instagramming versus experiencing the art for what it is.
Well, yeah, let's look at this from both sides, because on the one hand, you could say that this is driving a lot of people into art museums that would never go into art museums. So it could be a good thing.
Yeah. I think a lot of museum curators would agree with that, that, you know, whatever it is that draws people to an art museum is a good enough reason to have them there. I think maybe what's at stake is what we expect to get out of these exhibits. So if you're expecting that you go into this space and you get a great photo and you have a great selfie and you get to show people that you were there, then maybe that's not exactly what the artist had intended. If you were instead coming to this museum and thinking critically about the art and why it was created and how it's intended to make people feel.
You're not understanding or appreciating the art in front of you.
Yeah, I think some museum curators would argue that that's more important than going someplace and taking a selfie.
Now, this is not the only exhibit that has become this selfie art or Instagrammable art that has been talked about. The other one in cities like Miami, San Francisco, New York is the Museum of Ice Cream. Well, tell us, first of all, what that museum looks like.
Yeah, so the Museum of Ice Cream, I think in a lot of ways, doesn't fit our sort of standard criteria of what a museum is. this is a space that's definitely co-opted a lot of the structure of a traditional museum, but applied it to something that is really built for the social media experience. So it's a, you know, sort of a traditional museum style space where you go through different rooms and see different exhibits. But fundamentally, what these are sort of selfie backdrops. They're sort of colorful props and beautifully styled rooms that don't really offer much of an artistic experience as much as they offer a place for you to self-document your experience and post it online.
Like the strawberry room or the banana room or something like that?
Yes. Or most iconically, there is a sprinkle pool, which is sort of a miniature swimming pool that is filled entirely with plastic sprinkles.
So it's not really a museum. It's just a place where you can go take a selfie.
Yeah. And I think one of the interesting consequences of the fact that there is so much art that has become popular online, like the Rain Room or any number of Kasuma's artworks, is that there's sort of been proven to be this market for people who want to go to spaces and take selfies and, you know, pass that off on their Instagram as art. And so you can sort of skip that whole first part where you have an artistic process and an artistic critique of something and just go straight to the selfie by building a space that exists primarily for replication online.
So do you think that this is a trend, Instagrammable art, or is this something that has staying power?
Well, I think Instagram has changed our behaviors in all kinds of different ways, and that's not just in the art world. So you can, like, go to a restaurant and see all of the subtle ways that people's behavior has changed because of Instagram. People are taking photos of their food. Restaurants are designing their spaces differently so that they are sort of more attractive to people who want to have an Instagrammable experience. You can see it in, you know, retail spaces. And so I think the art world or the museum world is just another example of one way that social media is sort of shifting our expectations and our behavior in the world. But certainly because it's been proven that people are so excited and so eager to take the kinds of photos that are very easy to take in the Museum of Ice Cream or the Color Factory or 29 Rooms, that these spaces will probably continue to exist.
That's Ariel Pardes, who is a senior associate editor who covers technology and culture at Wired. Ariel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And you can see some of the selfies we've been talking about at hereandnow.org. Feral pigs are a problem across the South. That is especially true in Texas, where the animals cause more than $50 million each year in damage to agriculture. But these feral pigs are also called wild boar, and some entrepreneurs are finding ways to turn the pigs into profit. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav has the story.
Chase Roberts is piloting a helicopter and hovering a few hundred feet over a cotton field in east central Texas. He points to big muddy holes dug up or wallowed in by wild pigs.
So this is all pig damage right here. This is what pig damage looks like, all this stuff here.
Damage like this makes Roberts' company Hellebacon possible. People pay him and his partner Chris Britt to fly around with them, shooting pigs.
There's three along that fence line.
Britt points to three hogs that were shot during this morning's hunt, which ended with more than 15 killed. And while dozens of companies do aerial hunts in Texas, others want to change people's minds about the product.
This is good meat. It's free-range, self-sustaining food source. Mm-hmm. And it's a problem. We got a million hungry Texans, and why aren't the two connecting?
Bubba Ortiz is baiting a large metal cage trap with corn on the outskirts of San Antonio. He runs Ortiz Game Management, and people pay him to trap and remove feral pigs. Pigs like the one he finds in the next trap. It's about 150 pounds, covered in thick matted fur with tusks, and bleeding from the nose.
So he's banging himself pretty hard.
Trapping these pigs alive means he can sell them to a processing plant. He says prices are down and he'll get around 10 cents a pound.
You hear him chomping his teeth? He's giving you a warning. Hey, that's my foot.
Ortiz thinks wild pigs should be a bigger part of the U.S. diet, but he believes most people think of the meat as gamey or dirtier than domestic pig meat. He's been trying to counter that idea for years.
We even had a dinner one time. We're invited state representatives and the governor.
Every item on the menu of that 2014 dinner was made from feral pig, from appetizers to dessert.
Little pecan pies, and the crust had lard in it, rendered from feral hogs.
All with the purpose of trying to get lawmakers to see the potential of feral pigs, and to allot more money for managing and trapping them. But few showed, and the dinner had little impact.
Nice hot pan.
On a recent afternoon, James Baird Award finalist Stephen McHugh is frying up some wild boar sausage at his San Antonio restaurant Cured.
You can see it sears up real nice. Got a nice crust on there.
For more than a decade, McHugh has had feral pig or wild boar on his menus. He'll cure a whole leg for ham or prepare medallions. He says his customers love it.
Yeah, I think, in my opinion, they're always a little bit sweeter because of the wild grasses, because of the nuts, the berries, the things that they're eating. They're not surviving on a dried meal.
There's one thing, however, that feral pigs will never have going for them, says McHugh.
Oh, boy. They're ugly, yeah. If it's ugly or if it's cute, people don't want to eat it. You know, nobody wants to eat a puppy. But a cow is kind of in the middle, you know, so it's okay. Pigs don't have all the fur and the hair and all that, so that's okay.
He thinks people are waking up to the good qualities of the meat, but it has a ways to go before it's in your local supermarket. Mark Mitchell agrees. He works for Broadleaf, a New Zealand-based company specializing in game meats. Broadleaf owns one of only two USDA-certified processing plants in Texas and has been pushing feral pig.
And the market response has been phenomenal.
Mitchell says they've sold 20% more wild boar in the U.S. year over year the past 3 years. But it's still more common to find wild boar on European menus.
75% still goes to Europe, but we're talking about 1,200 metric ton being exported to Europe.
At 300 a day, they're slaughtering nearly all they get in, says Mitchell. If they slaughter more, they can guarantee volume, which many restaurants want to see before they put it on the menu. But the labor-intensive process for capture and the level of inspections can be prohibitive.
It's slightly more expensive than domestic pork, purely because there's a huge amount of costs and bringing them in live. Way cheaper than lamb. It's cheaper than probably half the price of beef.
Mitchell says as technology allows better capture methods like web-connected traps, volumes will go up, and he can better market feral pigs and serve more customers. For Here and Now, I'm Paul Flav.
Federal Reserve policymakers are gathered today for the last time this year, and in about an hour and a half, we'll find out if they'll raise interest rates. It will also mark Janet Yellen's last meeting as chair of the central bank. Joining us now is Marilyn Geewax, a senior business news editor for NPR. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with the main event at the meeting. Interest rates expected to go up today, right?
Yes, absolutely. Pretty much everybody thinks the Fed's going to make a change. It'll raise those short-term interest rates, a thing they call the federal funds rate. They want it to go up by about a quarter of a percentage point to 1.5%. That sounds like a small shift. It doesn't, you know, a quarter of a percentage point doesn't sound like much, but it's one of a lot of different steps that they've taken over the last 2 years. This is the fifth increase since December of 2015. It's the third this year. And this is the rate that banks charge each other for an overnight loan. But it matters. It matters to you and me because it's the rate that's a benchmark for all kinds of common loans, things we might have like a credit card or a adjustable rate mortgage. So if it goes up, and it probably will, it'll bite a little bit for average Americans. But Jeremy, remember, we're still way below where we were before the recession. It used to be 5.25%.
Right. And this meeting, by the way, marks the 10th anniversary of the start of the Great Recession. The Fed has kept interest rates very low for a long time now to help the economy recover. But it sounds like even though we haven't seen that much inflation, they feel that it's time to start raising them.
Well, there are at least some inflation hawks out there who think that you should really all the time be fighting inflation. Those hawks think that with the unemployment rate down to 4.1%, you know, employers are going to have to do something like raise prices so that they could get enough cash to raise wages. But all of that would create this wage and price spiral. But it hasn't happened. We're not seeing it. So that probably isn't the main concern. The real thing that the Fed is worried about is just getting back to normal. You know, we have a good economy now. The recession really is over. And this policy of keeping interest rates so low just doesn't really suit our reality anymore. So the Fed needs to raise interest rates to get us back to more historically normal levels. And that way, if there is another downturn in the future, they'd have a way to fight it. I mean, right. When times are good, you need to get rates up. And then when they're bad, you can lower them again.
We also mentioned that this is Janet Yellen's last meeting as Fed chair. What's her legacy going to be like?
Well, I think most people really feel that Yellen is going to be remembered as really quite a successful Fed chair. You know, the Wall Street Journal asked economists to give her a grade, and 60% of them, of the ones who were surveyed, gave her an A. Hmm. You know, an economist, that's a pretty tough crowd. It's not, you know, it's hard to get an A from economists. So she even got a better report card than her predecessor, Ben Bernanke, when he was leaving 4 years ago. Only 34% gave him an A. So she's been really popular. And you know, it's important to remember that when she came into this chairmanship, the economy, yeah, it was up from that terrible time of the worst of the Great Recession, but it was still kind of bad. You know, it was shaky. The recovery had been slow. There were still lots of people looking for work. Housing prices hadn't all bounced back. And she did it. She got the job done. We're in pretty good shape, and she gets an A.
NPR Senior Business News Editor Marilyn Geewax. Marilyn, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, Jeremy.
Percent of women voting in yesterday's Alabama Senate election went for the Democrat, Doug Jones. But that included almost all, 98% of black women voting. Just over a third of white women voted for the Democrat. An estimated 63% chose Roy Moore. Why? And why did they vote for President Trump, whose election prompted so many other women to run against his principles? Emily's List, which is dedicated to getting Democratic women elected, says 1,000 women asked for support before the 2016 election. Afterwards, and after the Women's March in Washington, that number surged to 22,000. Stephanie Shriok is president of Emily's List. Stephanie, is this a disconnect? White women still largely voting for Moore in roughly the same numbers that they voted for President Trump, but a growing number of women who want to run because they're opposed to Donald Trump.
Well, I think it's always important to remember that not all women are the same, and not all white women are the same. And we are seeing higher turnout from college-educated white women. We are seeing greater support in comparison to their non-college-educated counterparts for Doug Jones yesterday in Alabama. And to me, as I think about the winning formula for women candidates across the country in 2018, it is the college-educated white women, particularly in the suburbs and exurbs, mixed with the incredible energy and base of African-American women who continue to lead the way for the Democratic Party.
Well, and they talked about the woke vote, the women, black women in particular, leading the charge to get African-Americans to the polls to vote, in their case, against Roy Moore. I mean, let's be clear what they were doing, the woke vote. But talk a little bit more about this disconnect with white female voters. I mean, is it also true that maybe you're not representing the way a lot of women feel? And how do you change that when you see them vote for a Roy Moore or a Donald Trump?
Well, you have to remember that these often are women who are married to white men who are very certain of their support for people like Roy Moore. And we cannot forget that women are living in I call it sort of the stew of misogyny. It is everywhere in their lives. And there is great pressure to conform and be aligned with their husbands, with their families. And the first places that's starting to crumble is with the white college-educated women. And that's where we're seeing so much growth among voters for Democrats. We at Emily's List are seeing so many college-educated women of all races raising their hand, wanting to run for office. And you mentioned those numbers earlier. In fact, I should tell you, today we're over 23,000 women who want to run, and we had 66 women women sign up yesterday, just yesterday, saying we want to run. This is sort of a movement. We can't expect everybody to go all at once. And it's just going to take non-college educated women a little bit longer. It might take a long time because we have to break through the misogyny that has been their lives forever.
Okay, I want to talk about the number of candidates running. It is pretty astounding. Female House candidates, for instance, 354. That includes 291 Democrats and 63 Republican females. This is an increase in the number of candidates running for office. So Republican women are getting into the races as well. I just, before we let go of this topic, though, you talk about women maybe voting a certain way because they feel pressure from men. You know that the women that we've heard being so outspoken in the last couple of weeks in Alabama, the women who voted before that for Donald Trump, would be very offended by that. To them, it's, you know, their own choice, and they are choosing Roy Moore. And there's one thing that is driving a lot of these votes, and that is abortion. Emily's List has been said to be a pro-abortion rights organization. You are backing candidates who are largely for abortion rights. What do you do about that disconnect? That this is one issue. A lot of women said, I don't care about the charges. I don't care about tax cuts. This is the issue that I care about. How do you address that issue?
Well, as I said at the beginning, you know, not all women are the same. And to think that 52% of the population think all alike is a huge mistake. And we heard those voices in Alabama where they made it clear that abortion is their number one issue. There are also women in Alabama where access to abortion is their number one issue. And that's okay. These elections are not, at the end of the day, about one issue for the vast majority of the population. But they are for some. And that, you know, that's part of the work that we do. I mean, our job at Emily's List is to find a winning coalition of women and good men who stand with us to elect strong, pro-choice, democratic women. And that winning coalition starts with the leadership of African-American women. It is with Latinas and Asian-American women and a growing percentage of white college-educated women. And that's how I believe we see a wave of women get elected in November of 2018.
How much has the recent uproar over sexual harassment in the workplace on the part of very powerful men, it hasn't yet filtered down to, you know, the factory lines, but much has that propelled women into office? What are you seeing, or into running for office?
I believe this is all tied together. The women who marched in January and felt that they needed to have their voices heard stepped outside in their communities and then looked around and realized they weren't alone. Yeah. But I think that's why we're seeing the Me Too movement. And even this week, we saw the Democratic women in Congress step up and say that Donald Trump needs to be investigated because we are listening to the women who are speaking out. And that is such an important cultural change for this country. And now we've got to get it to the factory floors, and we got to get it to the waitresses who can't afford to speak out. We've got to back up all those women, too.
Well, women are speaking out in Congress, and the president is speaking back. Let's address the tweet he sent out about Senator Gillibrand saying that she would do anything for fundraising, a sexual insinuation there for many. But we're hearing that she and her backers are actually embracing that, that they say it reveals something about the president and elevates her. Your thoughts?
Well, I completely agree. We have continued to see this president use this coded language in so many ways, but particularly as it relates to women, whether it was Megyn Kelly early on or Senator Gillibrand this week. He continues to belittle and bully women. Now, to be fair, he also does that with other folks, but this is very particular, and we need to call this out. This is not appropriate. We are better than this, and our president needs to change his ways, and I don't foresee that happening, but that's what needs to happen. We need to change the tone and the language we're using.
Well, some people think that more women in the workplace will do that, and we mentioned the number of House candidates. There's also double the number of female candidates running for seats in the Senate. There's more men running as well. It seems like people are really wanting to get in the race to make change. But we remember in the 2016 election how much Democrats were trying to make of what they called a Republican war on women, the lack of the moves to eliminate all sorts of things like child care, the language from the Republican candidate. And it didn't work. Hillary Clinton lost.
But the shock of Hillary Clinton losing to that guy is, as Maxine Waters says, woke everybody up. And this is a different time. And women and men are stepping up, Americans across this country, to say, no, this is not the country we're going to be. This is not the direction we're going to go.
Quick lightning round. How much did the races in Virginia in the House of Delegates in November impact women? 11 women flipped seats in Virginia.
That's right. It was extraordinary. Virginia had a historic number of women on the ballot, 43 running for House of Delegates. I said every day we see women signing up to run. After those victories in Virginia, those numbers basically tripled every day for a week, because women not only thought I might run, but then they thought I might win. Mm. I got to do this.
Yeah.
It was fantastic.
Well, and what about the push to get Al Franken out? Many Democrats said it was too fast, too swift from the Democrats, and it equated him with behavior that they saw as far worse than his own misconduct.
Well, I think, we're at a place where we've got to listen to women, and we're going to have some really hard conversations about where we go from here. I don't know these answers, but I know that we're ready as a country to have this conversation, and it's time.
Stephanie Shriok, president of Emily's List, the National Political Action Committee devoted to electing women to office. Thank you so much for taking the temperature of women in politics with us. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for doing this.
We want to spend a few minutes now marking a somber anniversary. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock reports on a tragedy that struck a city in Indiana on December 13, 1977.
In the small towns that dot the Midwest, sports can tie everything together. What happened in Evansville, Indiana 40 years ago today tore everything apart.
Mary, Indiana 216, contact departure.
Air Indiana Flight 216 took off from the Evansville airport just after 7 p.m. It was a nasty night, misty and foggy. The plane was carrying members of the University of Evansville's men's basketball team, the Purple Aces. They had a game in Tennessee. They never made it. The plane crashed shortly after takeoff. Pat Wathen was the police reporter for the local paper, the Evansville Courier. He was on his dinner break at home when the call came in from the city editor. There had been a crash near the airport in a neighborhood called Melody Hills.
Well, that concerned me right away because I grew up in that area, and my parents live in Melody Hills. So my next move was to try to call them, and of course got a dead line. Found out later that's because everybody else had the same idea, and it just jammed the circuits.
The plane had gone down on a muddy hillside. When Wathen got there, he saw a small fire and bodies on the ground.
I actually glanced down on the ground and I saw an Aces duffel bag, and that's when my heart sank. That's when I realized, this had been the basketball team.
All 29 people on board the plane were killed. 14 were players on the Evansville team. The victims also included first-year coach Bobby Watson, members of his staff, and the team's radio broadcaster. Pat Wathen remembers the scene as the remains were taken back to the city on a railroad car.
And that was really an eerie scene that I think all of us recall, and because of with the fog and the mist and all that and the train whistle, as they were backing it up, there was a red flare that kind of glowed in the fog.
Rich Davis was another young reporter at the scene that night. A young boy had led him through the woods to the crash site.
Every adjective that you can use, from hopelessness to despair, this was a team that, I tell people, defined the city.
Evansville had seen some tough economic times in the 60s and 70s, but the basketball team put the city on its shoulders. It won 5 national titles in Division II. And then in 1977, Evansville moved up to Division I, the highest level in college basketball. Joe Atkinson teaches at the University of Evansville. He's directed a new documentary about the crash. It's called From the Ashes, the University of Evansville Purple Aces.
I walk past the memorial to that team every single day. And every day I would see the names carved in the monument. And I became very curious as to what the rest of their story is, because, of course, we all know the end. The end of the story is the plane crash. But I became very curious what the rest of their story is, as individuals and as a team, and that was sort of the genesis for the documentary.
Hi, I'm Craig Heckendorn from Cincinnati, Ohio, 6'2" guard.
Hi, I'm Mike Joyner. I'm from Terre Haute, Indiana. My high school was Terre Haute South. I'm a freshman at 6'3". I'm a guard.
In the documentary, there's archive footage of the players on the 1977 team introducing themselves. Some are still wearing their high school letterman's jackets.
These aren't names carved in concrete. These were kids who were very excited about being part of a new program, and all of a sudden that was taken away.
After the crash, there were 29 funerals. Reporter Rich Davis traveled to El Dorado, Illinois, for services for two of the Evansville players, Mike Duff and Kevin Kingston. They had been basketball stars at the high school.
There were so many people turning out that they moved the funeral to the gymnasium, and it was full. And they had the two caskets there on the floor with basketballs by each one of them. But it was heart-wrenching. It was really heart-wrenching.
In the weeks following the crash, Davis says the city turned back to basketball to try to ease the grief. The team from Southern Illinois University, Evansville's arch rivals, came to town and hosted a holiday tournament, which they won, cheered by Aces fans. Then in February of 1978, the Pittsburgh Steelers football team came to Evansville for a charity basketball game.
And that was the first time I remember laughter again at the stadium.
But people were also bitter. The families of the victims wanted to know why this had happened. The National Transportation Safety Board investigated, holding hearings in Evansville. In the end, though, the cause was traced to human error. It was an accident. Dr. Donald Moon lost his son Keith in the crash. Here he is in the new documentary.
There's got to be some anger there, I suppose. In fact, I know there is, but Keith would not want us to have vitriol and anger all the time.
Today, the University of Evansville will hold a service to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the plane crash. The documentary film, From the Ashes, will be shown on the local PBS station tonight. The Purple Aces play in Evansville on Saturday afternoon. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.